Welcome to Yale Cancer Center Answers with Drs. Francine Foss and Lynn Wilson. I'm Bruce Barber. Dr. Foss is a professor of medical oncology and dermatology, specializing in the treatment of lymphomas. Dr. Wilson is a professor of therapeutic radiology and an expert in the use of radiation to treat lung cancers and cutaneous lymphomas. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can contact the doctors directly. The address is canceranswers@yale.edu, and the phone number is 1-888-234-4YCC. This evening, we welcome Dr. David Cheng to the program. Dr. Cheng is Associate Professor of Diagnostic Radiology, Chief of Nuclear Medicine, and the Nuclear Medicine Residency and Fellowship Director at Yale School of Medicine. Here's Francine Foss.
Could we start the evening off by having you describe for us what is nuclear medicine?
Sure. Nuclear medicine has been around since about World War II. Actually, probably even before that, when Madame Curie discovered radium. And so it is the difference between nuclear medicine is that we use what's called a radioactive tracer. Tracer meaning the trace amount so that we do not induce any kind of pharmaceutical effects. But it gives us the biodistribution and it gives us the mechanism of action of the molecule. And so we're able to image because of the radioactive decay of the radionuclide.
How did you become interested in this field, David?
Well, actually, I started out as a scientist. So I got my PhD in biomedical physics from UCLA, and I was very fortunate enough to be trained and taught by the people who built the first positron emission tomography equipment. And so I got really interested in the physics and the technology of that. Then it was at that time that I realized that I also want to bridge over to talk to patients. And so I looked into medical school and I investigated and I volunteered like everyone else. And then I applied and fortunately I was able to be admitted. And so then I graduated and I did residency training.
David, can you just clarify for our listeners what your role is as a nuclear medicine physician? Like, what do you actually do and how do you interface with patients?
Oh, yes. So most of nuclear medicine today is diagnostic. However, we do therapies. The most common therapy we do is probably thyroid cancer, and we use a tracer called radioactive iodine. Thyroid gland is the only organ in the body that concentrates and traps the iodine. And so by giving the radioactive iodine, we can spare the rest of the body, the rest of the organs in the body, so that it is targeted for any kind of thyroid cells. So we do treatment in that sense for both hyperthyroidism as well as thyroid cancers. The others are really diagnostic, and we help our colleagues in terms of staging cancer patients as well as many, many benign situations such as acute cholecystitis for HIDA scan. We do a lot of pulmonary embolism studies for emergent shortness of breath patients. We do gastrointestinal bleeding scans, and so we do a multitude of many scans that we can help our colleagues.
David, what is iodine-131? Let's get back to the therapeutic side for a second. Describe that for us, and how do you measure the dose? How do you know how much to give? Tell us a bit of the detail associated with the management of thyroid cancer.
Yes, iodine-131 is only one isotope of many in the iodine family. Iodine-131 has interesting characteristics. For example, it has a gamma decay of 364 kiloelectron volts, as well as a beta particle with a maximum kinetic energy of about 606 kiloelectron volts. It is the beta emission that does the destruction of the cells, and hence we harness that for the therapeutic purposes. But the gamma emission enables us to image, and so if there are metastases from the thyroid gland, we will be able to visualize it.
So some folks get a little bit scared when we use the word radioactive, and you mentioned gamma rays and beta particles. Could you just go through a little bit briefly, what is radioactivity, what are the three kinds of particles, and how you use those?
Sure. So I think it is important to know that there are different types of emissions, and the radioactivity that we are most concerned about are what's called ionizing radiation. And so it is this high energy that ionizes the many molecules, gas as well as liquids, that I think people are mostly concerned about. However, the body is very resilient. In fact, if you take some kind of a damage, let's say from a diagnostic test, the body repairs itself, and it repairs itself very well. So it is quite safe when you understand at what threshold under which the radiation can be tolerated and the body can repair itself.
David, could you discuss some of the other treatments, such as Zevalin, Bexxar, what those are used for, and how you administer those for patients?
Sure. So Zevalin and Bexxar are what we call radioimmunotherapies. The immuno part comes from the antibody that is targeted for a receptor called CD20, which is in B cells. We tagged along a radioactive atom. Zevalin is the yttrium-90, and Bexxar is the iodine-131, so that in addition to the pharmacologic effect of the antibody, you now have the added radiation, that is local radiation, so that you can get a better control of the disease.
And David, when we give these therapies, I think it's important for people to know that this is kind of a one-shot deal, that you come in, unlike chemotherapy where you come in every couple of weeks and you get a dose. With these radio-labeled antibodies, you actually come in and you get a therapeutic dose, and then that basically stays in your system for a very long time.
That is correct. So it is important for everyone to understand that we give these internally, which is either in terms of the Zevalin and the Bexxar, it is an intravenous administration. So that, but the radioactive iodine is an oral administration. So, but however, once the body absorbs it, however, it, whichever route it goes through, it is up to the body to handle it and to excrete it. So we cannot actually influence its biodistribution. We could only understand the biodistribution and therefore protect the critical organs that we need to do.
And can you talk a little bit about precautions that a patient may need to take after they get one of these therapies?
Yes. So for the patient, him or herself, we are concerned about side effects, and that is damage to the critical organs. And different therapies or tracers will have different biodistributions. And so, therefore, different critical organs will need to be considered. In terms of bystanders, meaning family members, some of these isotopes have a gamma emission, such as iodine-131. The Zevalin with yttrium-90 does not really have a gamma radiation. However, it has some radiation called bremsstrahlung, which is a much lower energy. So the family members will get some radiation. And so we give a lot of advice on how to protect the family members in terms of the distance they should be apart, the amount of time, and how the patient should handle the excrements.
Are these outpatient procedures, David, or does the patient spend a night or several nights in the hospital?
So for Zevalin and Bexxar, they are outpatients. Radioactive iodine has been outpatient at Yale for many years. However, in the past, we have hospitalized the radioactive iodine therapies that are above 33 millicuries.
And are these therapies given at every hospital, or are they special to Yale, and can patients be referred to you for this type of treatment?
So radioactive iodine is quite widely available. However, I believe most hospitals do not do high-dose treatments. So, yes, we do get referrals from all over the state. I've gotten some referrals from New York as well, from Boston. So just because some centers are not comfortable in handling high dose therapies. In terms of Bexxars and Zevalin, I believe any center that has a good oncology unit as well as a nuclear medicine unit that can handle the radiopharmacy probably can offer these treatments.
So it's interesting, David, just going back in history, I was involved in the first studies with Bexxar, which is the I-131 emitting isotope. And at first, we actually did keep patients in hospital rooms, in lead-lined hospital rooms, before we really understood about the distribution of the isotope and the risk involved, which, as you said, is minimal. But that brings up another point I wanted to just stress, and that is that we actually can do things to protect normal tissue. And the Bexxar is a good example because we block the thyroid gland so that it doesn't take up the iodine when we treat lymphoma patients with Bexxar.
Yeah, yes, that's a good point, Francine. So any molecules that's labeled with iodine can potentially be cleaved off. And as a free iodine, of course, as I mentioned earlier, will then be taken up and sequestered in the thyroid gland. So if the patient has a thyroid gland, then there's a risk that the thyroid gland will soak up these free iodines that is a byproduct of the metabolism. So we do, as you mentioned, that we do give a high-dose cold, that means non-radioactive iodine, so that the thyroid gland will be overwhelmed and saturated with the non-radioactive iodine, so that the radioactive iodine will have a tough time competing against it.
David, aside from risks to the family and the precautions that go along with that to prevent problems, what sort of specific health risks might the patient be exposed to, and how do you advise them? What sort of things do you get concerned about as the physician when you administer these treatments?
So for radioactive iodine, the risks that we pay most closely attention to are both to the lungs as well as to the bone marrow. These have probably the lower threshold amongst the other organs that the iodine biodistribution will cover. And so we make sure that we are below a certain threshold beyond which there is a significant risk to permanent damage.
Well, that brings up the question of dosimetry, and I think we've touched on this word a couple of times in the conversation, but could you just explain to us what is dosimetry?
Yeah, sure. So dosimetry actually has a very long history, and I came across an article that it dates back into the late 1800s. But of course, over the years, we have gotten more sophisticated and calculations become more precise, and so we can better understand and also better predict the outcome of the radiation exposure. So dosimetry is really to estimate how much radiation dose gets absorbed in certain areas. And so for us, we do internal dosimetry. And so we are talking about different types of tissues, different organs, and with different isotopes, the biodistribution would be different. And so that's what we deal with.
We're going to take a short break for a medical minute. Please stay tuned to learn more information about dosimetry and nuclear medicine with Dr. David Cheng.
There are over 11 million cancer survivors in the U.S., and the numbers keep growing. Completing treatment for cancer is a very exciting milestone, but cancer and its treatment can be a life-changing experience. Following treatment, the return to normal activities and relationships may be difficult, and cancer survivors may face other long-term side effects of cancer, including heart problems, osteoporosis, fertility issues, and an increased risk of second cancers. Resources for cancer survivors are available at federally designated comprehensive cancer centers, such as the one at Yale Cancer Center, to keep cancer survivors well and focused on healthy living. This has been a Medical Minute, brought to you as a public service by Yale Cancer Center. More information is available at yalecancercenter.org. You're listening to the WNPR Health Forum on the Connecticut Public Broadcasting Network.
Welcome back to Yale Cancer Center Answers. This is Dr. Lynn Wilson, and I'm joined by my co-host, Dr. Francine Foss. Today we're joined by Dr. David Cheng, and we are discussing dosimetry in nuclear medicine. So David, we talked a fair amount before the break about the therapeutic procedures that you do. Tell us and our listeners a bit about diagnostic procedures and PET scanning, for example.
Okay. PET scan is one of the newer modalities in nuclear medicine, and PET stands for positron emission tomography. The signal actually comes from the annihilation of an antimatter called positron, which is emitted from the nucleus. And so we get the signal from the annihilation of this antimatter when it collides with an electron close to the origin. It is a very, very nice imaging modality. It is higher resolution than our gamma cameras in standard nuclear medicine practice. And also, we happen to tag on this kind of radionuclide with a molecule called deoxyglucose. So I'm sure many of you have heard of something called FDG, which stands for fluorodeoxyglucose. The deoxyglucose part is a sugar analog, is a glucose analog, and hence it kind of have the same distribution as glucose, except the affinity is not as high for the glucose receptors as regular glucose. Hence, we need to control the sugar of the patients we inject that in, and we have certain recommendations on how we can control that as part of a preparation for the patients before they come to us.
So, David, this is a little bit of a complicated question, but could you tell our listeners how it is that ingesting this radio-labeled sugar molecule detects tumor sites?
Yeah, sure. So we give this this molecule using the intravenous line, because if you give it orally, then the stomach would digest it, and then it would not get absorbed very well. So we give it intravenously, and as I mentioned earlier, it will follow the same biodistribution as glucose. And since the body thrives on glucose, it will follow wherever the organs that thrives on glucose the most, which it would be the brain. Other organs, including heart, liver, the kidneys, spleen and other organs will also need that. Now, if you have a tumor or an infection, either a benign or a malignant tumor, it has a higher demand for the glucose, and therefore the distribution of this molecule to those particular tissue types will be increased, and hence we get a contrast between what is normal and what is abnormal.
David, when we do a PET scan and say someone has a tumor in the lung, and that lights up, so to speak, on this scan. Do you do some additional imaging with the PET portion, such as a CAT scan, for example, so that one can see exactly where in the body relative to other organs that abnormality might be?
Yeah, so when PET technology first came out, it was a PET-only scanner, and now recently it has combined with a CT scan, so what we call a PET CT scan, and the CT scan provides the anatomic location of these abnormal signals. And so now we're able to not just say, yeah, it's in the lung, we are able to tell you which lobe it is in. And if it's in the spleen, we'll be able to tell you it's in the spleen and with confidence.
You had discussed some of the risks associated with the therapeutic procedures. Are there any risks with PET CT scanning?
There are very, very minimal risks. There is a CT portion, which provides some external radiation, which we at Yale we use one of the lowest techniques, meaning the lowest current, enhance the lowest radiation to the patient's body, that we could and still resolve the tissue types. And so we have one of the safest emission characteristics and profiles on that. So there's a minimal risk on that. And then there is the PET part, which is also minimal. The dose that we use is standard dose, and it gets excreted quite well in patients, and so the risk there is also very minimal.
The PET scan is extremely sensitive, and that's one of the problems that we've run into in the clinic, is that sometimes the PET scan will be positive and we do a biopsy and we don't see any tumor there. So can you comment on any ways that we might try to make this imaging technique a little bit better, or are we always going to be dealing with the fact that it's so sensitive that it's picking up everything?
Well, that is one of the problems, that it is very sensitive, and the specificity, unfortunately, cannot be improved too much on the technology that we have. However, let me say that there is a new PET MR on the market. It came on display in Chicago about a week ago, and I'm very interested in that. The MR can give you more information on the soft tissue that this signal is coming from. The CT gives you contrast and gives you anatomy. It does not give you as much information as the MR would.
Is there, David, at Yale a nuclear medicine consultation clinic? And discuss the interaction that you have with other physicians within our center here at Yale and physicians outside of Yale.
Yes, I started this clinic maybe about 3 years ago, and it came out of our thyroid treatment patient population, because we do a lot of counseling, we do a lot of coaching on patient, how to protect their family members and all of that. And it just took up too much time in our regular practice. So we decided to have that separate, so that we can dedicate the time, and we dedicate a physician, attending physician there, so that the patient can understand all of that and still have time to prepare their house, the environment in the house, and all their loved ones. Since then, we have also incorporated these precautionary counseling to all types of patients that need treatment. So Bexar, Zevalin patients are also part of that group. And although we don't do many of them, we do also do some samarium 153 bone palliative patients.
And does this require a visit by the patient and or their family prior to the procedure? What are the logistics of the coaching and counseling?
Right. So we time it such way that these clinic visits will precede the treatment by about 2 to 3 weeks, so that they have time to prepare and address whatever needs they may have. And we encourage family members to attend, but certainly at least the patient and the caretakers of the patient.
So, David, is this service available to outside physicians who, say, for instance, may have a question about whether a particular kind of nuclear medicine scan is appropriate for a patient?
The clinic is really aimed for the general population, and if they call us, we will not refuse to answer any of their questions, but they may not require an extensive counseling such as a clinic. If they are getting the services in another hospital, we never refuse to help anyone understand what's about to happen to them. However, currently our appointments have been scheduled for our patients, but we'll welcome any outside referrals as well.
What would be the best way, David, for a physician or a patient to contact your service?
The best way is probably to call our clinical nuclear medicine clinical area, and the number is 203-200-5610.
So since we have Dr. Wilson here today also, and Dr. Wilson is a radiation therapist or a radiation oncologist, I'm interested to know just from the two of you, if you could tell our listeners a little bit about what the interaction is between nuclear medicine and radiation oncology, if there are areas of overlap, or really what the difference is between what you do, Lynn, and what you do, David.
Well, David and I actually have worked together quite a bit over the years in both lymphoma patients and lung cancer patients, which are two types of patients I generally tend to take care of. And David's services have been terrific in terms of the PET scan side of things, in particular in helping me identify exact locations of tumors, their metabolic activity, if patients have localized versus more disseminated disease, and with the information that David's been able to provide to me, I could then formulate a treatment plan for that patient if we're going to use radiotherapy or radiation treatment, and that generally comes in the form of external beam treatment that's given by a linear accelerator. So actually, we've worked quite closely over the years in managing these types of patients with David helping me on the diagnostic side so that we can come up with extremely precise plans for these patients in terms of their radiation treatment.
Well, thank you. That was very kind of you, Lynn. I think with my biomedical physics background, I think there is a lot of overlap, or I shouldn't say overlap, but certainly similarities between our two fields in that we deal with radiobiology, we deal with how radiation interacts with matters, and quite frankly, also dosimetry as well, although in our case, we focus more on internal dosimetry. There's certainly a lot of similarities in that. The differences will come in that we cannot control where the radioactivity goes once we administer it intravenously, and so we have to know ahead of time how the biodistribution is, and we have to estimate if we are to increase the dose, what would be the absorption and exposure of organs internally from this radiation.
So, David, there are some interesting new advances in the whole field of nuclear medicine and looking at creative ways to image, say, intracellular pathways, for instance, in research. Could you tell us a little bit about where the field is going?
Yes. So there is a research arm at Yale called the PET Center. Again, the PET stands for positron emission tomography. And they are purely research, although they do human subjects as well as animals. There, they try to develop, they have a lot of radiochemists that try to develop specific tracers for specific questions for specific diseases. And by putting a positron emitter isotope onto the molecule, we can look at the biodistribution, the binding characteristics, and so we can get a lot of information from that.
Can you give us an example of how that might work at a different disease?
Okay, so I'll give you an example. Since the PET Center worked closely with some of the pharmaceutical companies, including Pfizer, who is very strong on CNS receptor work, so they do a lot of neurodegenerative research, and so they use these isotope tracers. One, to see where the biodistribution is, and then also to see what is the receptor occupancy so that they can dose their medication appropriately.
David, what do you think are some of the special offerings and techniques that might differentiate Yale from some other centers in the state and outside of the state? What do you think is some of the highest quality aspects of your program?
Well, I think in terms of technology, it is really if you have the resources, you can get the latest in the scanner. But aside from that, I think you have to look at the faculty. And I have put in a lot of time and effort in finding faculty for recruitment. And I think our faculty is... it's quite superior. Most of us have more than one subspecialty experience. Two of us have internal medicine as well as nuclear medicine. One faculty was an OBGYN practice before nuclear medicine. And the latest and the youngest of the faculty, although he only did nuclear medicine residency, he also has a PhD in health physics. And so we have, I think, a much more balanced and certainly a wider scope of understanding of the field. And to both protect and to advance the field of nuclear medicine.
Dr. David Cheng is Associate Professor of Diagnostic Radiology, Chief of Nuclear Medicine, and the Nuclear Medicine Residency and Fellowship Director at Yale School of Medicine. If you have questions or would like to share your comments, visit yalecancercenter.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and find written transcripts of past programs. I'm Bruce Barber, and you're listening to the WNPR Health Forum on the Connecticut Public Broadcasting Network.